The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Yeah, I find it curious to hear about the announcement of this Sati Center Day Long on Buddhism and neuroscience, and how little I know on the topic. And it's all this neuroscience is going on. I'm confident sitting here meditating. There's a lot going on in there, but I don't know what that is, the neuroscience of it particularly. So, but I do know, I don't know what exactly is going on in the inside, at least in terms of what is invisible to me, but in terms of what's visible or perceptible to this whole experience, I read an article this week that the subject of which I've read articles about this topic for, I don't know, 40, 50 years. It seems like this cycles through the same kind of idea. It seems that as time goes along, rather than getting better because we know about this phenomena, it just seems to be getting worse. That's the impression I get from the articles. And that is a degree to which people in our culture are excessively body conscious. And, it's been an ongoing thing. And now with selfies, apparently, there's this distortion of the face. But you have to have a good selfie. So I don't know how that works, I know a little about neuroscience and a little bit about plastic surgery, but I think that are they trying to match their face with a good selfie photo? Is that what they're trying to do? So it doesn't matter what you look like in real life, it just matters what you look like in the photograph. So I'm a little mystified by how it actually works in our society, but the degree to which it seems to be intensified in our society. And one way of not being surprised by it, that this is happening, is that it seems like when people spend a lot of time with their technology, with a lot of time on the web and all that, that it seems like it's becoming a more and more a visible world, an image world. And the videos are becoming more important than they were certainly 40 years ago. I kind of grew up even before these music videos that were really popular for a while. What are they called? On TV, that had all these music video that really popular. And I mean, I kind of grew up with TV, but TV was tame compared to what we have now. And so it's a world of those screens that puts people into the world of their ideas and thoughts and images. And I think that one of the leading causes of depression, a leading cause of probably insanity of some kind or other, is uninterrupted thinking. That if we spend too much time in the world of thoughts and ideas and we don't get out of it, too many people, I think, get into a distorted view of the world. Thinking is not necessarily so accurate, especially if it's uninterrupted. But if it stops and we can start over again, then the train of thought, the rumination that's going on, the self-talk that's going on, gets interrupted, and there's a chance for some kind of health to come in. But people who just constantly self-ruminate, constantly kind of this endless stream, left alone too much, left alone with their device, I think it leads to kind of faulty thinking of all kinds. And one of those kinds of faulty thinking is to be very concerned about self-image. You got to be self-conscious and body-conscious and all that. And they can get, quite intense for some people. But this has been going on for a long time. And I don't know when in human history this began, but it seems like it was existing even in the time of the Buddha, because there's one story of the Buddha and his son. Buddha had a son, not everyone realizes that. And the son, the Buddha left his family when the son was born, is the story. But the Buddha went back to his family when the son was 7 years old, after the Buddha was enlightened. Seems like one of the early things he did after he was finally kind of attained his quest was he went back to his home. And he didn't go back to live with his family, but he went back to visit. And as a consequence, his son decided, or somehow went off with a father rather than stayed with his mother, and became a novice monastic. And so I don't know how, if the Buddha actually raised his son directly or whether he was raised in the monastic community. But there's a few stories about this father-son interactions. And one of them occurs when the Buddha's son, his name Rahula, was like a young teenager. Some say he was 13 or 14. And they went out for their morning alms. Monastics can't keep food overnight. Whatever food they eat has to be food that's given to them the morning of the next day. And that day, that's what they can eat. And at noon, they have to forfeit whatever food is left over. And they don't eat between noon until next morning, and they don't save any food. So every morning, they wake up with no money and no food. And they have to then live on the generosity of people who want to feed them. And what monastics will do is walk into town if they're out in the countryside, or walk through villages with their bowls, alms bowls, and people will put food in it. So the Buddha and his son were off together on this alms round, and so the Buddha would be in front and his son would be behind. And it seems that what happened, if you read between the lines, is that the son, being, I guess, having half the genes of his father, kind of looked like his father. And the Buddha was like, the big guy, right, of at least that religious tradition. And so the son got a little bit of conceit that he was good-looking like his dad. And so it's not so unusual, maybe, for a 13, 14-year-old to be concerned with their looks and what's going on. And so even back then, that was going on. And so the Buddha somehow understood that this was happening. Maybe the 13-year-old was strutting, monastic strutting or something. I don't know how you do it back then. I should quote it accurately, the Buddha says to his son. So he says to his son, any kind of physical form, whatever, whether past, future, or present, internal, external, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near, all physical forms should be seen as it actually is with proper wisdom thus. This is not mine. This am I not. This I am not. This is not myself. So apparently he was thinking he was hot stuff physically. And the Buddha says, anything that, any physical form, any shape that you have, any look that you have, that's not really who you are. In any kind of way of assessing, that's who you are. Don't identify with it. And and I guess this was such a timely teaching, just given what the son was thinking, probably, that the Rahula said, who would go into town for alms today when personally admonished by the Buddha? So, you know, that little saying, you know, don't take anything physical as, you know, yourself, that was an admonishment. So, you know, we don't quite know between the lines what was going on. But so my idea that he was kind of proud of his looks is, you know, an interpretation. But something happened there. So he was admonished for that. And so then he turned back. He ended his alms round, the sun, and he went back to camp. And so that day he wasn't going to eat because he wasn't getting any food. And he went back and sat down at the root of a tree, folding his legs crosswise, setting his body erect, and established mindfulness. So he sat down to meditate. But then the Buddha's kind of main disciple, Sariputta, saw him sitting there, and he said to him, "Rahula, develop mindfulness of breathing. When mindfulness of breathing is developed and cultivated, it is of great fruit and great benefit." And so I guess he'd never heard the instructions on mindfulness of breathing. So that evening, Rahula got up and went to his father and said, "Can you teach me mindfulness of breathing?" And so the Buddha did and taught him. And but he taught him a variety of things first in preparation for that. The first he taught him was how to be aware of his body, how to tune in to his sensations of his body and be aware of those sensations. And that was the beginning. And then he taught him how to do loving kindness and how to do compassion practice and things like that. And that he taught his son how to have equanimity, practice equanimity. And then on that foundation, he taught him mindfulness of breathing. And what he did in doing so was he showed his son, or taught his son, how to develop a very different relationship to one's body than one can when a person's involved with their ideas and images of the body, body image, and what people think of my body and what I look like and how I show off or something. In a sense, that's all surface thoughts. Those are concepts, ideas that kind of are not very deep within. And so instead, by teaching meditation, he was teaching a very radically different way of experiencing oneself or knowing oneself. And a kind of direct contact with oneself that provides a very different reference point for who we are, how we live, or what's important, or what we feel. When you're really in touch with your body, really grounded and connected in meditation, there's a very strong tendency to see thinking in a different light than we can if we're running around our life and kind of busy in our thoughts. We're kind of spinning kind of in a... One teacher once says that for many people, thinking is like an endless loop of a freeway on-ramp that's never you can never get off of. You know, just kind of spinning and caught and, you know, probably in rush hour traffic. And So to be living in that world is actually quite shallow. And to be able to drop down and feel the physical body and sense it from the inside out is actually, you know, it goes from a two-dimensional, one-dimensional way of living to multidimensional. Just so much more of our life is here in the present moment. And we get a very different relationship to our thinking. Rather than having thinking, giving it a lot of authority or focus on it as being so important or being the final say, thinking can be seen much more as provisional. Thinking can be seen much more as optional, you know. Maybe it's true, maybe it's not, maybe it's not that important. It doesn't kind of have so much glue that we get caught in. And so this kind of continual rumination tends not to happen for people who are really well grounded or settled into their body, experiencing this from the inside out. And for one reason for that is that meditation is one of the things that interrupts the train of thoughts. And it's really important for some people to have their thought train interrupted so that this, you know, unhealthy ruminations, self-talk can stop and then get a different perspective. When you really meditate deeply and well, it's not, you know, not really necessary to stop the thought train. It's, even if it still goes on a little bit, it's not really a train. It's just bubbling up of thoughts and you don't have any sticky glue to them. And then people get a very different relationship to their body. or to themselves. There's a place, if you get really into mindfulness of the body and mindfulness of breathing, and the breathing becomes a relax, you know, soft, there's a feeling of kind of reassurance. There's a feeling of safety, a feeling of goodness, a feeling of wellness, a feeling of stability, of safety, of confidence, of well-being, of happiness. You know, different people, different ones of those words work for what happens to them. But there's a whole different kind of feeling or way of being that comes into play. And to be able to develop or feel a sense of well-being, feel good about yourself, to have an internal reference point for feeling whole, feeling fine, feeling complete, feeling okay about yourself, can be really strong and palpable in meditation, because it doesn't require ideas. It doesn't require having a better biography. It doesn't require having a better, you know, story to tell people, or a better identity, or better, you know, things, or you know, more likes on your Facebook page, or, you know, it doesn't. That's not where it's at. It's just, it's kind of the sense of well-being dwells and settles inside. And what's fascinating to me, to even watch this day, to watch having that, getting into that, and having that with me into my daily life, and then watching the forces inside where I kind of start departing from that, and kind of go into that rumination, into the thought. And it so seems so simple in daily life to kind of get involved in all the concerns of the daily life and the thoughts involved, and this has to happen, that has to happen. And pretty soon I find myself kind of in that world of thoughts again, more than I'm in the world of my connected body or coming out of here. And so fortunately I have a practice, and I recognize when this is happening, and then I can come back and get settled again. And I do that repeatedly through the day. And I think my life is so much more comfortable because of it. I'm pretty confident that if I just let my mind have free rein to only think, and that's what my whole experience of life was, what I was constantly gurgitating in my mind, not only would it not be good for me, it probably wouldn't be good for you. You know, it's, this mind. Some people have said the mind has no shame, but that's kind of a strong word to use, and maybe not so nice thing to say. But, you know, the thinking mind, at least for some people, is not the wisest part of who we are. And so if we give too much rein, freedom to that thinking mind, it's, you know, it can cause difficulties. So you see in the teachings of the Buddha a tremendous emphasis on mindfulness of the body, a tremendous emphasis on being centered and grounded in the body, so that awareness, presence, being conscious, happens through the body. Awareness is not one of the big changes for me in my years of practice. Was that before I practiced, and someone had asked me, "Where are you aware? Like, what if you're going to point to where in your body you're aware? Where are you aware?" And before I meditated, I certainly would have pointed up here to my brain. That's, you know. And then after some years of practice, if someone asked me that, I would have pointed to my chest. That awareness resides in my body, not up in my head. And then at some point, someone asked me, I would not point to my head or my body, but I would just spread my arms in a wide circle, like it's just all here. There's no, you know, awareness that you know, where are you aware? I'm aware everywhere at the same time. It's like holistic and whole. But it's holistic and whole through the vehicle of the body, through the senses and the nerves and everything happening here. And that was a, you know, excuse me. There was no magic moment or key or, you know, flipping a switch for that to happen. But it was the slow and steady, day after day meditating, coming back to my breathing, coming back to my body, coming back to the present moment over and over and over again, that began to awaken my capacity to feel my body, to be connected to my body, and to sense and feel through the body, so that my experience of myself, of this being here is not in the head, but kind of radiates outward from some inner center to include everything. But in radiating outward, it goes through my muscles, it goes through my nerves, it goes through my bones, kind of. And so all the information, all that's there, becomes a counterbalance to being lost in thought, counteracting with thought. So the Buddha emphasizes over and over again his emphasis on the importance of being in the body. And he emphasized it also for ethical reasons, that people are much more ethical when they're connected to their body. There's something about the reference point of our physicality that gives us a different kind of set of informations about how to behave, what our impact is, what the sources of our behavior is inside of us. That's very different if we're up there in the control tower in the head. and so here are some examples of things he said. So first introduction, he said, Buddha said, when mindfulness of the body has been repeatedly practiced, developed, cultivated, used as a vehicle, used as a basis, established, consolidated, and well undertaking, these benefits may be expected. One becomes a conqueror, it's a strong word, one becomes a conqueror of discontent. Isn't that the light? Nice. Do you want to be a conqueror of your discontent? And discomfort. And discomfort, discomfort does not conquer oneself. One abides overcoming discontent whenever it arises. So discontent. How many of you are controlled by your discontent and discomfort, and things have to change, and you get angry at people or get irritated easily, and you know you say things you don't wish you hadn't said? Only one person admits it. Oh, you're not alone, I'm sure. So mindfulness, something about mindfulness of the body, being centered and grounded in your body, that it allows kind of to discharge the tension of it or not get caught up in the thoughts of it or the feelings of it. It allows a whole different kind of reference point of maybe kind of more spacious, more clear, more grounded, where we don't get caught by discontent. Then he goes on and says, one becomes a conqueror of fear and dread. And fear and dread do not conquer oneself. One abides overcoming fear and dread whenever they arise. And I still get nervous at certain times in my life. Nothing like I used to be. When I was 20 or 19, I dissociated because I was so afraid once. Fear was a big part of my life. And now, you know, I have some nervousness left. But because I have a strong connection to my body, when the nervousness arises, I go back and just feel it in my body. I sense it and I kind of rest in it in a sense. And it's like the body, the physical body, becomes a, like a kind, supportive friend for the nervousness. It's like supported or helped or cuddled or something. And so it allows that nervousness to relax. And so that kind of softens away. So, it's not something that really bothers me or interrupts my life in any kind of way. Because I think I attribute a lot to this ability to feel it and be grounded in my body. If I go up to my head and say, why am I nervous and what happened to me and then should I be nervous and what did that person say and what should I do and what are the causes and what's the reasons, and it's back to that freeway, on-ramp, spinning around. And it's much less direct than just kind of dropping into the body and feeling it there and having it somehow be no longer a problem. And then the Buddha goes on to says, if one has a strong mindfulness of the body, one bears cold and heat, hunger and thirst, and contact with gadflies, mosquitoes, wind and sun, and creeping things. Is that what you want? one endures ill-spoken, unwelcome words. So that's nice. So one endures. So something about being centered and grounded in your body, you're less likely to be triggered by people say mean things to you or unkind things to you. And it's, you know, you still be wise about it and know how to take care of yourself. But the triggering, the reactivity is less likely to happen if we're kind of centered and grounded in the body. The body's like ballast. And then he goes on to say that bodily feelings that are painful, racking, sharp, piercing, disagreeable, distressing, and menacing to life, you bear those as well. That's useful. You know, if strong pain, and you know, sometimes the aspirin's not available, the pain medication's not available, and we just have to somehow manage with the pain. And I didn't do it consciously, you know, or intentionally, but in my early years of Zen practice, I worked on the Zen Green Gulch Farm, which is the farm that Zen Center in San Francisco has. And farm work is kind of, you know, physical, heavy work. And there was lots of occasion where the work was physically painful. Sometimes, like, we were carrying these really heavy things across fields, and, you know, I wasn't not so strong, and so it really hurt my hands or my arms. And it became very interesting for me to kind of explore and feel what was going on with me with those strong pain. I knew it was optional. I could put things down. But to really stay there and see what was all the reactivity I had, what were all the fear I had, what were the impulses I had that were trying to get away from it or be discouraged or upset or get angry or something. And how could I manage to just be holding these things that were so painful to hold and the intense pain that I experienced? And how can I have equanimity with it? How can I just be spacious about it? And it just seemed like the natural thing to do when I was doing there. And I don't know why it was so unintentional. It just felt like the natural thing to do. But I think maybe because of all the meditation I was doing. The meditation I was doing was a training in how to have a non-reactive mind. And that felt so good to have that. And why would I give up that good mind? And so the idea of kind of exploring when I started to lose that mind, that became an interesting area to explore, to work with, and try to find how not to lose that equanimous or peaceful mind. And so I think that's probably why it was unintentional, just like just natural. Of course I don't want to, you know, give up on this training to have this kind of mind or this kind of way of being. So here for the Buddha at least, that here are some examples of how mindfulness of the body is, he thinks it's, you know, really supportive. And then he says, with strong mindfulness of the body, one obtains at will, without trouble or difficulty, the four jhanas that constitute the higher mind and provide pleasant abiding here and now. So the idea of being able to get deeply concentrated. Some people associate deep concentration with as a mental activity, as a mental kind of art or skill. And just if you do the right thing with your mind, then you'll get concentrated. But here the Buddha says that what really supports developing strong concentration is to be really grounded in your body. And it's almost as the body gets concentrated. It's not the mind. It's almost that like that. The body gets settled and composed and unified and all that. So to keep coming back to the body, keep coming back to the body, and have the body be the source of attention. There's some theory that the Buddha was clearly countering ideas of the ascetic traditions, religious traditions of his time, who considered the highest goal was to disconnect from the physical world, to go so fully into a mental world that you no longer experience your body, you no longer experience even sights and sounds in the world around you, and really kind of went into kind of very heightened, reified, simplified, altered state of consciousness where even consciousness kind of disappears. And there's one theory that the Buddha actually didn't emphasize this. He kept emphasizing the importance of staying in your body, And with mindfulness of the body, you discover how not to cling. You start discover how to be free. There's one little passage where he, One abides with mindfulness of the body established, and then with a expansive mind, one understands as it actually is, liberation of mind, and that liberation by wisdom, wherein unwholesome states of mind come to an end. So the idea of moving out of unwholesome states of mind, of unskillful states, states of attachment, is not done by disconnecting from the body, but it's discovered with a relaxed, expansive mind grounded in the body. That's where the work can be done. And people who doubt this, that this is so important for the Buddha, there's in this text called The Numerical Discourses of the Buddha, there are some, I don't know, 10 maybe, little discourses. They're like two, each discourse is two sentences. And they're very repetitive. But when they're repetitive, they're making a point. And so it's referring to what's called the deathless. The deathless, amata, is one of the great lofty terms in Buddhism. Some people consider that it's synonymous with nirvana. It was a pre-Buddhist term for kind of the ultimate, and it was often considered to be, before Buddhism, a transcendent state, some a transcendent place beyond this lived life that we live, the experienced world we have. And the idea was to go somehow experience this transcendent state, quite removed from this world. And you find that in still to this day, in Buddhism itself, this idea that the deathless is a transcendent state that's really completely other than this physical world that we live in, still persists. And somehow tuning in or discovering this kind of completely other realm of existence that's called the deathless is sometimes taken to be the purpose and goal. But listen to what the Buddha had to say about this term, because he often took terms that existed in his religious ideas that existed in his time, and he kind of redefined them for his own sense. Rather than criticizing them, he just kind of defined them differently. He said, "We do that, but this is what we do." He's a good politician, I guess. Bhikkhus, monks, they do not partake of the deathless who do not partake in mindfulness of the body. They partake of the deathless who partake of mindfulness of the body. So there's no experience of the deathless. Not like for those people who are not connected to their body, the physical lived world, there's no experience of what the Buddha calls a deathless. So this is not a transcendent thing. And then he goes on. There's next, you know, all these little discourses. Bhikkhus, the deathless has not been partaken by those who have not partaken to mindfulness directed to the body. The next one. They have fallen away from the deathless who have fallen away from mindfulness directed to the body. They have neglected the deathless who have neglected mindfulness directed to the body. They are heedless about the deathless who are heedless about mindfulness directed to the body. They have forgotten about the deathless who have forgotten mindfulness directed to the body. Do you get the idea? I mean, he really wants to make a point here. They have not pursued the deathless who have not pursued mindfulness directed to the body. They have not developed the deathless who have not developed mindfulness directed to the body. They have not cultivated the deathless who have not cultivated mindfulness directed to the body. This is important enough for the Buddha to repeat. It's probably okay that I do it too. They have not directly known the deathless who have not directly known mindfulness directed to the body. They have not fully understood the deathless who have not fully understood mindfulness directed to the body. They have not realized the deathless who have not realized mindfulness directed to the body. So you better not neglect mindfulness directed to the body, whether you're a 13-year-old teenager who's a little bit caught up in their self-image, or you're a person just trying to become liberated and free. It's been one of the great joys of my life and one of the great benefits, one of the great consequences of this practice, that I have developed, the degree to which I've developed a connection to my body, this mindfulness of the body. And it's kind of like I said last week, it's kind of like experiencing the world inside out, or it's kind of experiencing the world from the inside outwards. Whereas if I experience the world through my thought, the vehicle of my thoughts and ideas and concepts and stories, it's really, outside-in kind of experience. It's kind of a disconnected, it's actually disembodied and disconnected, that not a very useful place to be. But to feel and sense the world, myself, and who I am, it's a whole different game, how to be. An exercise I like to do to point this out, some of you have maybe done this with me. If you look at your hand, and some of you, some point in your life, you probably had some thoughts that your hand wasn't quite up to, snuff. It wasn't quite what it should be. It was too big, too small, fingers are too thin, or too thick, or fingers are too long or too short, or too many wrinkles or not enough wrinkles. there's something about these hands, right? I mean, it's fairly common thing people to do. And if some of you maybe can remember, it kind of feels kind of bad and kind of depressing, and put your hand behind your back, hoping no one notices, But if you close your eyes and don't have any of those thoughts about your hand, don't look at it, don't think about it through that lens of what other people will think if they see your hand or something, and just feel the hand in and of itself. Just feel it vibrating, feel it humming, feel it pulsing, feel the warmth and coolness, feel the softness and maybe the hardness that might be there, the tingling. The hand itself, the sensations of it, the feelings in the hand, in and of themselves, they exist independent of the ideas of what the ideal hand should look like. Those sensations exist independent of whether the hand is too short or too big or too small or whatever the ideas are. The hand in and of itself has none of those problems. The problems, where do they live? They live up in that ruminating place, the control tower. If that's all you live, you probably go and get, plastic surgery. But if we can just begin to appreciate and love and delight in the liveness of the hand from the inside out of the hand, we have a very different reference point for the hand. The same thing is true for all the rest of our body. If we can feel the humming, the aliveness, the flow, the energy that exists in the body, unencumbered by the ideas we've had, the ideas that many of them which are inherited from our culture in all kinds of dysfunctional ways. If we can kind of free ourselves from that, or those ideas and those concepts, and not try to please a cultural model or what other people think or what other people want from us, but really kind of trust the sense of well-being and the sense of beauty that we can have, that is not the beauty on the surface, but the beauty that flows from the inside out. The beauty of the energy, of the flow, of the sensations, of the goodness that can live in here, that can arise from mindfulness of the body. So, mindfulness of the body. So, this is a little bit of and wanted to give this talk, I really wanted to emphasize that this ancient Buddhist tradition that ends up having produced big books like this, all these big books, if you want to read them all, one of the most important things they're telling you is don't read the books. Cultivate and develop mindfulness of the body. It's your body is the book that you want to read. Really trust it, drop into it, and learn to live in your life. Learn to live your life out of your body instead of out of your head. It's one of the best things you can do. And it's a slow process to wake that up and develop that. And it's one of the great things that you can do. And it'll certainly support meditation practice and help meditation really kind of come alive, and I think in a wonderful way. So I hope that you love your body. I hope you become your body's best friend. And then your body can become your best friend. Wouldn't that be nice? All of you have completely good and adequate bodies. Completely, 100%. I see no one here who has an inadequate, imperfect body. I guarantee it. It's all, like, perfect. Don't waste any more time feeling insecure about it. Go inside and let the goodness inside flow out and just show you the confidence, the goodness, and the freedom that you can live in if you kind of just, you know, don't care so much about the thoughts, ideas, stories about this body. Your body is completely adequate. Thank you.